All right, Scott. Looks like we're going to be back for part two of Wild Bill Cody tonight.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I've been really waiting on this, and you're gonna have to excuse me because I got sinus issues going on. So,
There's no
but
excuse.
yeah,
Just don't be sick.
if it was that easy, I would totally appreciate it.
Do you have anything you want to go over before we get into this? Anything you want to
Not particularly. I think that we might want to do like a little recap though for people because it has been, what, 2 weeks
Correct.
since we talked about old Wild Bill Cody and all of his mischievous behaviors and manipulative tactics.
Well, I'm not going to do a full recap
No,
per
I would
se.
just
We'll
give
just,
something.
if you want a recap, or if you're just tuning into this one, I would say step back to part one of this and catch up to where we're at. Before we get into it, thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. All the episodes you listen to, you like, subscribe, everything helps our channel. So just do want to say that we appreciate you.
Yes, absolutely.
So as far as a recap goes, like I said, if you're just tuning into this one, this is part two of Wild Bill Cody. This is the one that's going to get into the murders and rape that he committed. It's going to be three murders and one rape. And we're going to go into the more of the details of what happened with that. Part one touched on his early life and went through marriages and kind of just give you a backstory of who he is and what kind of con man he actually is. So to go ahead and just dive right into this one, we left off at his first wife, Karen, has been kind of strung along from Bill year after year. He started calling. He would call her all the time, always there. She had got to the point where she finally told her husband's name is Fred, and she had finally told Fred that Bill had died. So where we left off was Fred came outside, gave Karen the telephone, and it was one of Bill's sisters on the phone that told Karen that he had just killed three women.
That's right. I remember that.
So carrying on from there. Carrying on from there. Sound like I said
I
Karen.
see what you did there. Carrying on from there. I see what you did. I see it. You're a putty little dude,
Oh. So
you.
July of 1998, Bill didn't have a job at this point in time, but yet he still continued to go to all the bars he went to the strip clubs he went to. He would leave 150% tips at everywhere he went. He threw money around like it wasn't anything. Yet, no job, nothing to show for what he's doing. The money that he was throwing around at this point in time when he was going to these strip clubs, he had took from Rebecca Holberton. They said he had took her for probably as much as $70,000. She's one of the ones that he did kill. And we got Candace Walters that he killed as well. And they said he took her for about $6,000.
Wow.
Rebecca had told a friend that she was wanting to get Bill out of her life at that point in time. But before she could get him out of her life, she was wanting to find a way to get her money back. So like I said, it was probably upward of $70,000. He had been living with her since around July of 1996. And while he was living with her, Candace Walters was his secret lover he had on the side. And he had signed promise notes to her that he would pay her back. And that was around $6,000. Walters was now threatening that she was going to go to Rebecca Holberton. That's who he was living with. She was going to go to her and tell her about the affair and what's going on if at this point in time if he did not start repaying this money back. So we're starting to build this. He's starting to get trapped.
Almost like a blackmail.
Where we're at right now, it's kind of setting up this perfect storm for Bill to do what he does because he's starting to get cornered. You know, he's starting to get threats from one of the women at this point in time. So June the 30th, 1998, Bill had come up with his plan then. He went to a hardware store. He bought 4 eye bolts, nylon rope, duct tape, and a 7.5-pound splitting maul.
Wow.
Then he goes back to the townhouse that he was living at that point in time with Rebecca. It was her townhouse.
Okay.
She was in process at this point in time. Rebecca was getting some renovations done at her townhouse. So there was no carpet going down the hall. It had all been removed, so it's just plywood floors at this point. And then there was butcher paper up in the windows. You know how some people do whenever they're doing remodeling, they'll put the paper up so you can't really see inside. You can't, you know, just, it's under construction.
Right.
So this is also setting up for his perfect storm. Everything's already covered. Sliding glass doors covered with butcher paper. And if you don't know what butcher paper is, it's this thick brown, like brown paper sack type of paper. Can't see through it. Covers everything up really nice.
It's almost like painter's paper.
Yeah, but thicker.
But thicker.
Right.
Way thicker. Yep.
So the windows, sliding glass doors, everything was covered with this paper already. So everything was already pretty much set up for him as far as concealing what's about to happen. So he gets a chair, puts it in the middle of the room. He goes and gets Rebecca Holberton. And he tells her that he has a surprise for her. She was thinking that this surprise, he was going to repay her because he had just told her that he was about to get millions of dollars from a settlement that just went through. So earlier that morning, before he went to the hardware store or anything, he had her write out checks for more than $56,000 to pay off all of her debt. He sat her down, opened a bottle of champagne, and put a briefcase on her lap and told her to put her hands on top of the briefcase. So she's sitting in this chair, middle of the room, hands on the briefcase, on her lap. Then he covered her with a blanket so that she couldn't see anything. And she was waiting for her surprise. While she was covered up with the blanket, he went, he got the maul that was in the other room, come back down the hall, stood behind her while she sat in the chair, and he brought the blunt side of the maul down on the back of her head with all of his force.
Oh, boy.
Completely caved in the back of her head, gouged a 2-inch piece of her skull out that flew across the room, still had hair attached to it. Holberton fell immediately on the ground. Bill wrapped her head up with some clear plastic. He said he wanted to catch the blood. Then he tied all of her limbs together, wrapped her up in black plastic. Said it looked kind of like a Halloween decoration is what her body looked like then. Wrapped it up in black plastic and tied it all up so it looked like a Halloween body. And then he placed her against the wall. So that was it for first day of what happened right then.
So that's, and he had no remorse to it or anything?
He said he did. And all that I'm going over right now pretty much came from the court transcripts. And yeah, after we go through how the murders go, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that was said in court. But most of everything that I'm telling you about right now comes from his court testimony plus confessions with the police officers.
Okay.
So the day after he killed Rebecca, he told Candace Walters, that's the other woman he was having an affair with, that he was about to receive $52 million in this settlement. He told her that back in the day, this is some of the stuff back and forth of how he conned these women into thinking the things that he said were true. And this next part, we're going to come back to it again later also. But he told her that back in the day, he was a hitman for the mob. This is one of his things that he goes on about with a lot of women. He had a target that was assigned to him as he was a hitman for the mob, and he went and warned the target that there was a hit out for him. And the so-called target was so grateful that he spared his life that he left his entire Las Vegas estate to Bill. So that is what this $52 million settlement he's getting that he's telling Walters about now comes from this. So now he can pay off his ex. And if you don't know the ex we're talking about, refer back to part one. He has a daughter with his fourth wife. That is another one of his cons that he plays with all these other women, is he is trying to provide for this daughter, trying to fight his ex for... I didn't find anything he ever said about custody, but fighting his ex for being able to see his daughter, trying to care for her, stuff like that. Which, you know, we know as we keep going that that's pretty much a con too. With him acquiring this Las Vegas estate from the target that he saved, he's going to be getting $52 million, and that's also going to give him enough money that he can pay off his ex and get custody of his daughter now. So, with one of the women he's conning, obviously, you start talking about custody of kids, and women are going to be, a lot of these women have kids themselves, so they're going to be more, you're pulling at those heartstrings now, right?
Yep.
So, he told her that he was going to pay her also, just for keeping silent about what his former jobs were.
There's nothing sketchy about that.
So he was a hitman for the mob. He was, we'll get into some of these other ones too. There's several of them that he would tell them that he did. And the part about being silent about the jobs and all, that's going to come into play with these women that he chose to kill. That's some of the things that some of these triggering points for him that eventually led to everything happening. He told Candace Walters that he was going to pay her. Started out at $100,000 and they were going to fly out to Vegas to go get it. Then it went from $100,000 to he was going to give her $1 million and a new 4Runner. Then they're not going to fly out there. They're going to take the 4Runner, drive out there, because there's going to be a big party that the family's throwing him when he gets out there, because the whole family's thankful for him saving this target. So there's a whole entire party that's going to go on because he's part of the family out there. Then it changes to he's going to give her $2.5 million. That being $1 million in cash, and then he's going to give her the rest of it by wiring it to her bank. And she's going to get a new house that's right down the road from his house that he's acquiring, the estate he's acquiring in Las Vegas. He's going to get her a house that's going to be right down the road from his in Las Vegas as well.
And she actually...
That's one of the reasons why whenever I started reading about this case that I wanted to do, make it a two-part, because I wanted people to hear about the beginning of it. You know, the cons that he did. Because if you just heard this right now, how is anybody going along with this?
I know I wouldn't personally, but...
But knowing what you know from beginning, of the kind of con man that he was, everything's leading up to this. These women that he's talking to right now, these are not strangers on the street either.
No.
All these women, he's had relationships with them. He's living with one of them. One of them's one of his lovers. It's not a stranger on the street. So all of this that he's saying and doing, it's been building up to this.
Right.
And I'm more than sure there's probably been times in the past, just like with Rebecca, he put a blanket over her head so she can be surprised. How many people is going to go along with that just right out of the gate? This has got to be something that he did prior to this, right? I mean, wouldn't you think?
I would personally think maybe some kind of.
Because otherwise, who's gonna be like, yeah, just throw a blanket over my head. That's the way I'm going to be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, and not to get too weird with it, but I mean, they could have had some kind of kink, per se.
Well, I mean, you from part one, you know some of the things he did.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
And he's definitely one of those characters.
So carry on. The properties that he was telling Walters about, Candace, the properties he was telling her about, he had a photo album with him showing pictures of these properties. Printed out pictures, opened the album. We're flipping through the albums, looking at pictures of these properties. So, I mean, it's not like he's just saying something and saying, we're just going to go there and find this. He's got it all planned out. Photo albums of the properties, it's a whole orchestrated plan.
This has been a thought in his brain. That's how it would seem in my opinion. This was not a spur the moment situation. This was a...
No, the rubber band didn't just snap.
No. Well, this man's got some serious issues.
So, that one part, the photo album, that's one of the things to solidify what he's saying to her, right?
Yeah.
He also had her call her bank to find out with them exactly how they wanted him and her to go about wiring the money, because it's a large amount of money he's going to be wiring, $1.5 million. So he got her to call the bank to find out how did they want this wire transfer to transpire. So everything he's doing, I mean, it leads up. These lies are extravagant.
Super extravagant.
Right. So, I mean, it's not like he just said a couple things and she's just going along with it. He's putting the proof out there. He's getting her to call the bank. He's got the photo albums. I mean, he's putting the legwork in. It ain't like this just a straight up, they were just fooled straight up. It was a show.
Which we know that Wild Bill Cody, that's what he was about.
Right.
It's all he was about.
He was a showman.
Just putting on a show.
July the 2nd, Candace Walters, she sold her car to a car broker, because this is the day that Bill's going to be bringing her the new 4Runner. So she don't need her car anymore. So she goes and sells the car.
That's where she messed up.
The next morning, Holly called her. That's her daughter. Holly calls Candace, and she told her that Cody was running late, but he'll be there soon. So this is where we're starting to set up for people missing. And he did show up, and he told her that he was going to take her over to the townhouse, because that's where he didn't have the car yet, the 4Runner. It was being delivered, and it was going to be delivered to the townhouse. So he goes and picks her up. They go to the townhouse. He takes her inside because the car's not there yet. The 4Runner's not outside. So he takes her inside to, you know, it's going to be just a little bit for the car to get there. The room is dark. It's got the butcher paper over the windows, the sliding glass doors. It's dark. He don't turn a light on. It's just a dark room. He walks her in there, gets her to sit in the chair. I'm sure there's enough ambient light in there to, you know, move around. But he gets her to sit in the chair. The room is fairly dark. So she don't see any of the blood that's on the floor, that's splattered on the walls. She doesn't see any of that. And all this I'm going over is, this is all parts of what Bill had to say. So he brought her inside, sets her down in this chair. With it dark and with the windows covered the way it was, she couldn't see the blood that was splattered on the walls, the blood on the floor. She couldn't even see Rebecca's body wrapped in black plastic, propped against the wall, feet away from where she's sitting in the chair. If she did see it, he don't say anything about it. Everything's normal. He did the same exact thing with her as he did with Rebecca as well. Told her he had a surprise, but she would not let him cover her up with the blanket because she just had her hair fixed up for this trip that they were going to take to Las Vegas, and she didn't want to mess her hair up.
So she's intelligent.
Ish. I think they all were. Honestly, I mean, I don't think that these, the women that he killed, I don't really think that they were so much that it was that they were stupid about what they did. It was more of, he got them to a point, I mean, I don't know how they got involved with him anyways, but he got them to a point of, like I said, it wasn't strangers. He disappears. He comes back behind her, maul in his hand, raises it up, brings it down on the back of her head, blade side down this time. He hits her 4 times, 7.5-pound maul. Boy. He hits her 4 times over the head with this maul.
Why so many?
After she falls out of the chair, obviously she is dead at this point. Then he urinates on her head.
You don't say.
Then wrapped her head with some white plastic, just like he did with Rebecca. And he moved her body a few feet to the side and just covered her body up with a blanket. He didn't wrap her body with the black plastic the same way he did Rebecca. I don't know if he just didn't have the plastic or what, but he didn't wrap her up. He just put a blanket over her. Then he took both women, Candace and Rebecca both, then he took their credit cards, their bank information, and it was time to go party some more. The recount of these events that I'm going over came from court transcripts. So after he got to this part, when they were going over all this, he also did say he promised throughout this trial of when they were talking that he was not going to cross-examine his rape victim. Because what I'm telling you right now is the parts of this is when we only have one witness that's there because one woman survived. So Suzanne,
right,
was her name. She's given some of these accounts of what's going on, the things that was told to her, which we're about to get into that also of why she knows the things that she knows. Because all of this that I've been telling you up to so far is he told Suzanne of what happened. So he did promise that this, all of what I was telling you right now is what Suzanne was going over. Bill was representing himself as his own attorney in this trial, and he promised that he was not going to cross-examine the rape victim or any of the family members of the women that he murdered because he didn't want to cause any further pain to them than he already has. So now we're going to go to part of Suzanne's story. So in 1997, Suzanne was roommates with Beth. They met each other at work, and they became quick friends and roommates. They would very quite often, they would go out for drinks together, they would go hang out. They would even hang out at a bar called Shipwrecks that's really close to where they worked. Which we'll find out later, Shipwrecks was one of Bill's, which they called him by Cody. If you remember in part one, I told you he goes by several different names.
Yep.
So they knew him there as Cody. But this is where she met Cody at, because this is one of Bill's main hangouts. It's called Shipwreck. This is where she very first met him. And this is one of the places he always hung out with his cowboy hat, his duster, cowboy boots on. It was his signature outfit. Beth wanted Suzanne to go on a double date with Cody and Jimmy. Jimmy is best boyfriend. She wants her to go out on a double date with him. She agrees. So Bill called Suzanne, told her where to go to, the Sheraton Hotel on 6th and Union. He told her when she gets there, go to the front desk, tell them who she is and who she's with, that she's part of his party and that she'll be taken care of. So when she got there to the hotel, Beth and Jimmy were already there. And when she got there, she knew she did exactly what he said. He would, you know, he lined all this stuff up. She goes to the front desk, tells them who she is, that she's there with Bill's party. She knew that he had money. She knew that he had something going on because of how accommodating they were to her. They took care of her. Anything and everything. They were over the top with what they did. So she knew that, like, he was somebody. And that's the persona that he always gave off.
Right.
So she goes and gets with Beth and Jimmy. They wait on Bill to show up. They do their night up just like, you know, the normal way that he always does. Beth and Jimmy, soon after that, they broke up. Beth begins seeing Bill also. Suzanne also was seeing Bill.
So we got the whole scenario going right on over once again.
I mean, it's just one after another after another. He would always try to show off that he had a lot of money and everything that he did, which we know that thus far. One time for her birthday, Bill and Beth came over. Because you remember, Beth and Suzanne, they was roommates. They had an apartment together. Bill and Beth had been out partying. They come show up, and he threw $100 all in ones all over her bed and told them it was her birthday to take all that and y'all just go have a good time. So why did he have all the ones? You already know why.
Mm-hmm.
He spent all his time at strip clubs also. Everywhere he always went, he always paid for everything everybody did. He wouldn't let anybody else pay at any point in time when they went out with him. He always had to pay. Every time. He never told these women where he lived, besides he's going to have the estate out in Las Vegas, places like that. He never told them where he lived at. That he split most of his time between Denver and Las Vegas. And he kept all these photos of these houses in a 3-ring binder that he kept with him to show off to everybody. So in mid-June, he started telling Suzanne about a surprise that he wanted to give to Beth. So at this point in time, him and Suzanne's not, you know, they're not seeing each other. It's him and Beth. So he told her that he was going to be getting her a new car. And one of the other jobs that he was telling people that he did was he is also a bounty hunter. That's one of the other jobs that he's been telling people around. So that's what, from the shipwreck bar, they knew him as being a bounty hunter. Also told Suzanne that he wanted her to come and work for him at a mortgage lending business that he had. One of the locations for the business was in Las Vegas. One of the locations was in Colorado. That's the reason he was going back and forth between these, is what he's told Suzanne. He wants her to leave her current job that she's at and go work for him. But you can't tell anybody about this job offer that I've gave you.
Of course.
She immediately told Beth about the job offer. And her and Beth discussed it, and both of them didn't think that Cody would do anything to hurt either one of them. Because they've known him for so long. He's been around. They've known him. He's always taken care of them. They know the way he is. They didn't think there was any kind of danger. So Suzanne decided that she would go to Las Vegas and see what this job offer is all about. She's going to go out there with Bill. She's going to find out, you know, just check everything out and let's see what's going on with it. Bill told her that they would be going there for 2 nights. And Suzanne would not agree to that. She didn't like the idea of being gone with him there for 2 nights. So he immediately changed it. As soon as there was any kind of disruption to what his plan was, there was no disruption whatsoever. He just immediately changed it to, we would be gone for 1 night. He's going to pick her up on Sunday, July the 5th, and they'll be back on Monday. So on Friday, July the 3rd, Suzanne and Beth were told to walk across the street. There's a pizza joint across from their apartment, and he was going to meet up with them there. In wild Bill Cody fashion, they go over there. He shows up about 10 minutes late. He comes walking up. He told them that his truck had a flat tire and that it was at the tire shop just right down the road getting fixed. Right after he does this, they're right there at this pizza joint. He drops down on one knee and proposes to Beth right then and there. She said yes. Right after she said yes, Bill gets up, walks into a liquor store. Suzanne thought this was kind of weird, but Beth just laughed it off and she told her that it's just a joke. He's just playing a joke. This is not for real. Given what's going on right now, remember, 8 hours before he's standing at this pizza joint just cutting up with them, 8 hours before that, he had just killed Candace Walters with the maul, split her head open. 8 hours before all this is going on, just like nothing's ever happened. Just a normal day doing normal Wild Bill things. He returns back out of the liquor store with several of the little airline bottles of liquor. You know, the little shot bottles, I guess you would say?
Yeah, little singles.
Yep. So he comes back out of the liquor store and that's what he has. They went to 2 bars and then went to a gentleman's club. This particular gentleman's club, it had a restaurant on one side of the club, like a restaurant and a lounge over there, and then on the other side was the topless bar. This entire night, he was paying for everything with cash, which we know where the cash came from. He got their debit cards and bank account information. He had already been to the ATM before he came and met with them. He got $403 out of Candace Walters' account, and he got $1,287 out of Rebecca Holbertson's account.
Okay. So we got fraud.
I mean, I think the fraud's the least of our worries at this point, though, right?
No, definitely. Definitely is.
So Suzanne, they're at the gentleman's club at this point of the night. Suzanne and Beth, they went together to go to the restroom. While they're in the restroom, some woman comes into the restroom and asks for them by their name. They thought it was odd. But then the woman told them that Cody told her to come into the restroom and come and get them. So, with this being said, they went with a woman. She took them back across the gentleman's club to the topless side of the establishment and had two dancers perform for them that he had already prepaid for the dances.
Yeah, because that's what everybody wants.
After the dances, he gave both the women handfuls of ones and told them to leave it all on the stage for the dancers. Gave the handful of ones to Suzanne and Beth and told them to go and leave it on the stage for the dancers. They got back home around 3 a.m. and Cody stayed with Beth that night. So we're going to back up and regroup on this again real quick. This is the next day. He just got done killing Rebecca and Candace, and now we're out just partying it up. The next morning, when they woke up, he was gone. But he was back by that afternoon for the 4th. It was the 4th of July then. So he was back by that afternoon for the 4th. So whenever he comes back, he got back about 7 p.m. He was early, so they got something to drink. And then he told Suzanne that he wanted to show her best surprise, but it's at the townhouse. So Suzanne goes with Bill to the townhouse to go see what best surprise is that he had told her about. He pulls the car into the garage and closed the garage door. And he told Suzanne that this is a dress rehearsal for what he wants to do for Beth. So what he's wanting her to do is, you're going to play the role of Beth now for me, please. We're going to run through this whole thing. This is our dry run. I want you to run through this like you're Beth. We're going to go with the whole thing. Is that okay with you? So Suzanne's like, you know, that's her friend. So she's like, sure. You know, she wanted Beth to have an amazing surprise, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for this dress rehearsal, he said that he needed to blindfold her and duct tape her mouth.
Oh, my God.
Because that is exactly what he's going to do when Beth gets there. Because, you know, every woman loves for their mouth to be duct taped for a surprise, right?
Well, of course. I mean, do you not like your mouth being duct taped for a surprise?
I thought that's what you do.
Just asking.
He takes a piece of cloth. It was a piece off of a bath towel. He ties it around her eyes. He asked her, could she see? She said no. But what she didn't tell him is she could see where it went over her eyes. This strip of cloth, she could see if she looked straight down, you know, beside her nose. She could see the floor. But she couldn't see out in front of her. And then he took the duct tape and taped her mouth shut. He told her to take a hold of his arm, and he was going to lead her into the house and down the hall to go sit down. This is we're doing this dry run. She takes his arm. They start walking down the hall. She takes his arm, and they start walking down the hall. As they're going down through there, she can see down, and she sees the plywood floors. This is the point where she starts getting pretty sketched out about what's going on, because she knows nothing about this. She just knows now she's in this townhouse and there's plywood floors down there. Something's not right.
Mm-hmm.
He walks her back into the room. He turns her around and tells her to sit down. Well, as she's sitting down, it's a long ways down. She knew that she wasn't sitting in a chair, that she's sitting, she's going down way too far. When she sat down, she realized she was sitting on a mattress then. That's when he began to tie her up. He had already got the rope and the eyelets. He had already fastened eyelets over. He tied her legs, spread eagle, tied her down to the bed. Arms out, legs out. She began to cry immediately and asking him to please let her go. He told her to shut up, that she hasn't seen cold and mean, and she didn't want to see when he gets cold and mean. He then opened up her blouse, he cut off her bra, cut off her pants, and cut off her underwear. He took the blindfold off of her, took the duct tape off of her mouth, and he asked her had she ever seen a human skull before. Obviously, she said no. Bill walks out of the room, comes back into the bedroom where she's now tied down to the bed, naked, has an ice cream wrapper in his hand. He opens the ice cream wrapper out, and he pulls out a piece of bone that still had hair attached to it and lays it on Suzanne's bare stomach. That's from earlier. Yeah, from earlier. That's the piece of Rebecca Holberton. That's the piece of her skull. He then walks over by the fireplace, lifted the blanket.
Go ahead. Man, I'm sorry, not to cut you off, but this dude
this is crazy.
This is beyond anything that I could have imagined. Like, at first I thought this was like a greed type deal, just wanted money. But no, this dude's a
wait till we get past this and we get to the trial part where it goes over his reasoning of why he does all this. It's psychotic. I mean, it comes down to he's just psychotic. He lays the piece of skull on her stomach. He walks over by the fireplace, lifted some of the blanket up, and she could see a leg sticking out. Then he looks back at Suzanne and he tells her, the black plastic you see over there, there's a body in there as well. And then he walks over to the black plastic where Rebecca is wrapped up in that plastic and kicks her body really hard. All of this part that I'm going over right now is still part of Suzanne's questioning during the trial. And remember, Bill is representing himself in here. So several times he's not an attorney, but there's several times through this questioning process of when they would ask different questions, like at this point in there, they asked her, what was going on in your mind at this time? In a normal trial, that's when the defense would come back with, they would have an objection to that. But Bill didn't.
Right.
So everything in this trial that goes to these transcripts, he just sits right there and is quiet. Lets everything be asked, lets everything be talked about. Where a lot of trials, when they have a proper attorney, is going to have objections to things that are asked. Right.
Shut it down, pretty much.
It don't get that way with this. Everything gets to be, all the questions that are asked gets to be answered. So she responded, I thought I was going to die because I didn't understand why he would show me what he did and then just let me live.
Yeah, that is strange.
Bill then taped Suzanne's mouth back shut again and started to fondle her legs and breasts. Then he said that he had to leave and go get someone else. He told her that she better not make any sound or the people that are upstairs, they would hear her and they're going to come down and they won't be as nice as he was. That a guy would come down and rape her until she dies.
So now he's playing the BS card.
Correct.
Trying to make it where nobody knows what's going on. So now he's lying, saying, hey, this is what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. That's what it boils down to. He's playing the BS card.
So he covered up Suzanne head to toe with a blanket, and then he leaves. She can't see anything at this point. She can just hear. She counted two music videos played and two commercial breaks played. By the time that went on, he was back, and he was whispering to someone. And then she could hear duct tape being unrolled. You know the sound it makes.
Oh no! Yep.
Then after hearing the duct tape being pulled off, she heard Bill ask someone, "Can you get out of that?" And then you could hear the sound of duct tape being pulled apart. And then you could hear more duct tape being applied again. And then Bill says, "That's better." After that, then she hears Bill ask whoever it is that's in there. He hears them ask them, "So how's your day going so far? We're just having a casual conversation." So then Suzanne heard the woman respond back to Bill, and that's when she recognized her voice, and it was Angela Fite. Whenever everything was being asked, Bill did confess to the police that he showed Angela the bodies, and he told her, because she couldn't hear him of what he was saying to her, during Suzanne's testimony about this particular part, she couldn't hear what he was saying, but what was being said, Bill actually told the police, was he showed Angela the bodies and he said, "Welcome to my mortuary."
Wow.
Yeah. Suzanne remembers the blanket being pulled off of her lower body, and she was being groped up her upper thighs. And then the blanket came all the way off of her, and she could see Angie about a foot from the end of the bed in a chair that she was taped to. Angie is what she called her, Angela.
Mm-hmm.
So Angie's taped to a chair about a foot from the bed. He's uncovered Suzanne now. She is tied down, spread eagle, naked, laying on the mattress in front of her. Angie looks at Suzanne and told her that she was sorry. And she said, and she asked Suzanne, she said, "We're not going to get out of here alive, are we?"
Nope.
Bill didn't really pay any attention to them and them talking to each other. He just sat right there in a plastic, outside plastic chair.
Okay.
It was beside the bed. He just sat right there in the plastic chair, smoking a cigarette. He would take the cigarette out of his mouth, come over to them, and let both of them take pulls off of the cigarette. That was with Suzanne. He went to Angie, and he asked her, "Can you smoke without using your hands?" And she said, "Yes." So he stuck a cigarette in her mouth. He lit it. He let her smoke a cigarette. When she was done and she spit the butt out, or he took it out of her mouth, then he retaped her mouth back shut. He would untape it, let her smoke, tape it back.
So they didn't think to yell or shout or...
Suzanne's already been told, "You start making noise, whoever it is upstairs is much worse than him."
That's true.
At about 11 p.m., Suzanne saw Bill leave the room that they were in. She saw him leave, and then she saw him come back into the room. When he came back in, he was behind Angie. Angie didn't even know he was there. He came back into the room out of the darkness, and as he came into the room, she said his hands were already up in the air with the maul in his hands. As soon as he comes into view, she just saw him bring the maul down on the back of Angie's head, killing her. She fell to the side right after she was hit and killed. She couldn't fall out of the chair because she was taped to it. Remember, her arms and her legs are both taped to the chair. So she just slumped over into a unnatural position.
Right.
He hit her 6 more times with the maul after she had already slumped over. The first hit killed her. He hit her 6 more times.
I mean, I would think the first hit would have killed her. It's a 7-pound maul.
7.5-pound maul.
Yeah.
After he hits her 6 more times with this maul, he bends down and picks the cigarette up that she was smoking, bends down, picks it up off the floor, and finishes smoking the cigarette.
So Dude's twisted.
That's the cigarette that popped out of Angie's mouth right after he hit her with them all.
Ugh.
After he was done smoking that cigarette, then he stood up, looked at Suzanne, took his pants off, took his underwear off, left his shirt on, untied one of Suzanne's hands, made her touch him. Then when he was had enough of her doing that with her hand, then he untied her other hand and her feet, pointed his gun right at her head. He gets up, walks back behind Angie's body, tells Suzanne to get up, come to him, and kneel down beside him, made her put him into her mouth right there beside Angie's dead body.
Fellatio.
This is when Suzanne, she asked Bill then, am I going to die? And Bill said, do you want to? She said, no. He didn't say anything else to her at that point. He took her back to the mattress, and then he finished raping her. After he was done, he tied her legs back together and tied one of her hands back to one of the eyelets, and he left her other hand loose. He sat back down in the chair, the plastic chair, and smoked cigarettes and watched TV. And talked to Suzanne like everything's perfectly normal. He started asking her, was she familiar with the movie that was on? Did she know the name of the movie?
What?
Shortly after that, she did ask him for a blanket. She asked, could he put a blanket over her? He got a blanket, put it on her, and she asked him to come sit beside her and lay down beside her. And the reason she...
Oh, so she's playing with his emotions at this point.
No, she said the reason she said that was she wanted to know where he was at.
Ah.
She didn't want him to have the opportunity to sneak up behind her the way she did Angie, the way he did Angie.
That's smart.
When he laid back down on the mattress with her, she held his hand. And she said at some point in time she went to sleep, but she held onto his hand the entire time.
She was asleep, but she wasn't asleep.
She said she fell in and out of sleep at some point. But yeah. The main thing that she wanted to do, she wanted him not be able to sneak up behind her, and she wanted to hold his hand. Because as long as she was holding his hand, she said if he got up and moved, if she did fall asleep, she would wake up. She would know he's doing something. He kind of took this more of a caring gesture.
Mm-hmm.
But this was survival mode at this point.
Right.
The only time that she got up off of that mattress at that point in time was she had to go to the restroom. He took her to the restroom that was upstairs. She said she never saw anyone upstairs, but as they were going upstairs, she was told that she could not look to the left because that is where those people were at, were to the left, and they didn't like being looked at, and she didn't want to upset them. So she kept...
Did this guy have some kind of... excuse me. Did this guy have some kind of like mental disability or something?
I mean, the things that we know about him as far as early life that he talked about was... the affair he had.
Well, what I'm more so questioning now is, could he possibly have had schizophrenia or something?
I don't think so.
Or is he just that much of a...
I think he's just twisted.
Compulsive liar.
That, and he's just twisted. Very, very twisted. The next morning after this, he untied Suzanne so that she could change clothes. And then they left in Rebecca Holberton's truck, and they went back to Suzanne's apartment. When they got back to her apartment, he went through the apartment and he collected all the phones, the cordless phones that were in the apartment, cell phones. He collected every single phone that was in there, and then he told her that she could go take a shower. After she was done showering, he told her not to unpack any of her stuff, that they still had places to go, and he didn't need anything to look like that they were back, and nothing to look like the trip wasn't happening. He wanted everyone to still think at this point in time that they're still going on this trip. So they left the apartment. He was hungry, so he took her to a restaurant, and he insisted that both of them order lunch and eat, which I'm sure at this point in time she really didn't have an appetite, but he insisted that she order something. She kept thinking to herself, and I mean, I could only imagine it was pretty much just being in shock at this point, but she kept thinking to herself that this can't be real. This can't really be happening. That all the people that she saw, that it's not happening. That they're still going to be alive. They're going to wake up soon. That this is not real. After they got done eating breakfast, he took her with him. They had to go shopping. He stopped. He bought a tape recorder. Then he went to Blockbuster and rented the movie The Jackal.
I chuckled at you saying Blockbuster because I have not heard
Blockbuster.
Blockbuster. Right. Since I was a kid.
And the reason he rented the movie was because that was the only way that he could fully describe what he did for a living. Because he told people, remember, he was a hitman. The right. Movie The Jackal is... Bruce Willis plays in it, and he's a hired hitman. So he wanted her to see that movie because that describes what he does.
So another lie.
Yes. Then they went back to her apartment again, and he told her, he gave her cell phone back, and he told her to call Beth. She calls Beth to tell her about how good that the trip to Las Vegas was and how good it went. Beth she told Beth that, you know, when she gets back to the apartment that they're back and they had a movie to watch. Beth comes back to the apartment. They all watch the movie The Jackal together. The entire time this is going on, Bill's acting just like nothing in the world's happened. He's being himself. He's being Bill, the Bill they know, the entire time. He promised Suzanne that after this movie was over, after they got done watching it, that he was going to tell Beth everything that's happened. So after the movie was over, they all got up, they all went to the kitchen table, and Suzanne began telling her about the events that have
transpired.
Transpired. Thank you. Nice word.
Surprised I knew that word with public education.
Suzanne began telling Beth about everything that had transpired, but she couldn't finish. And so Bill finished telling Beth the whole story. Later that night.
So he's proud of it. He's not even hiding it at this point.
No, he's not. And like I said, as we get towards the end, when we're going to get to some of the things that Bill says during the court, it was all part of his plan. Later that night, Bill sat down there at the table with that tape recorder, and he gave nearly a 2-hour confession onto the tape recorder sitting at their table. While he was talking and giving the confession, he took his gun out of his waistline of his pants and he set it on the table right there with him so that they could see his gun as he was giving the confession. After he was done, he let them go to bed and to their own rooms. Suzanne said that after she woke up the next morning, she was scared to leave the room. She said she just wanted to lay there in bed as long as she possibly could, but she knew that she had to get up. She eventually did get up, and she comes back into the kitchen. Bill is in there with Beth, and Bill told her and Beth both, that he needed to go some places and told them not to call anyone or tell anyone anything that's happened or anything they know, or more people will die. So they were scared enough to just comply with what he said.
Yeah.
They just stayed there. They didn't call anybody. They didn't do anything. While he was gone, Suzanne got all of her clothes that she had had from that townhouse. She put it all into a plastic bag and she hid it in a closet. She told Beth that if anything were to happen to her, the plastic bag is in the closet and it has all of the important evidence of what happened in those clothes. When Bill got back, he told the two women that they could invite a male friend over if it made them more comfortable. They both immediately thought of the same man. His name is David Kane. He's 34 years old. He's a friend of Beth. Beth called him, and he came on over. When David got there, he was met at the front door by Bill with a gun. So I'm going to stop right there. You got a friend. She calls you. You go over there and this happens. He lives. Spoiler alert. He lives.
Okay.
After this happens, from then on out, if one of your friends just calls and just some kind of weird, hey, won't you come over? I'm good. I'm good.
Either that or make sure you got your heat with you.
Something. But I mean, just like you said, make sure you got it with you. But I mean, what are you going to do? You go over, if one of your friends calls over, you're just going to start like showing up at all their doors, just knocking with a gun in your hand already?
Hey.
So when he was met at the door by Bill with a gun, Bill tells him, you can stay or you can go. That choice is up to you right now. But if you do decide to go, there will be consequences for everyone involved in this right now.
This dude's like he's playing all kinds of mind games.
Well, of course. Well, I mean, we know that. He's been doing that his entire life.
Well, yeah. It's just, it baffles me. That's all. It just really baffles me.
After this was said, Dave did stay there at the house with Beth.
Okay.
Bill sat him down at the kitchen table where the tape recorder's at and pressed play. He let the tape play so that Dave could hear the entire confession, and he knows now of what he's now been involved in. He knows everything that's going on as well now.
Yep.
All of them got into Bill, into Dave's vehicle, and he made Dave drive Bill, Suzanne, and Beth to the strip club, where they stayed until it closed that night.
This man and his damn strip clubs.
Yep, he loves a strip club.
Good gracious.
Oh, and that reminds me, in part one, I did tell you that the strip clubs he stayed at so much that they would play a song when he walked in. I just thought about what it was. It's Strokin's the name of the song. As soon as he walked into the club, the DJ would play that song as he was walking to his seat.
Wow.
The next morning after...
I don't really know that song, but it sounds quite provocative. It
probably is. I looked it up. It's an old school song.
Is it provocative?
Just look it up. Listen to it.
I'll look it up.
So the next morning after this is now July the 8th, Bill began to make his plans for what's about to happen going forward. Every single day that they've been together, he's said that he's going to leave and go commit suicide. Every single day he has not left yet. Finally, this time, he concocted this plan of what's going to happen, and he did leave. But before he left, he made sure that everyone had very explicit instructions on what to do when he leaves. First thing, Suzanne is to call 911 and tell them everything that happened. After she makes the phone call to 911, all three of them are to go outside of the apartment, sit down in the grass, and wait for the police to show up. He wanted it to be done just like that because Bill was afraid that if the police showed up and they were still in the apartment, that they would confuse Dave for Bill and that Bill might get hurt by the police. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. Dave might get hurt by the police.
I knew what you meant.
When the police show up, Beth was to give the police Bill's pager number. Yeah, now we're going back, just like Blockbuster times. We got pagers again, too. And the exact time of when the police supposed to call that pager number to give him a message. As soon as Bill leaves and Suzanne calls 911, step one went just as planned. She called 911, but it all went downhill from there. They did not go outside. Suzanne was afraid to go outside. She had already watched him kill Angie. She was afraid that's another one of Bill's plans going on, that as soon as they were to go outside and sit down, they were going to get shot. That's what she was afraid of. So they did not go outside. They were also told not to call anybody, not to do anything. Dave immediately takes Beth's cell phone, and he calls somebody. So I mean, like, his whole entire plan is just falling apart right out of the gate.
Yeah.
The police show up just shortly after that. When they did, Dave's still on the phone with whoever it is that he called. Suzanne and Beth were both hysterical of everything going on. Because now, at this point in time, you got to thank Suzanne. Even though they've been back at their apartment and all, Suzanne's still been trapped.
Yeah.
From all this. This is her first time right now of starting to actually be free from it. Suzanne begins telling the story to the police of all that's happened as well. One of the things that she did say also was whenever they left the townhouse, went to the apartment, then they went shopping, they drove by that townhouse a few times while they were out doing the things that they did. Bill even told her one point in time that they're probably going to have to go back to the townhouse one more time. So immediately in her head, if they're going back to the townhouse one more time, what's that for?
You already know what that's for.
That's what she thinks. She's like, he's going to take me back and kill me as well.
He's going to kill me because that's what he's done with everybody else.
Every time. She said they passed back by this townhouse several times, and she said every single time that she just knew, this is it. We're about to stop. This is it. I'm about to die. And she could not.
Horrible feeling.
You know it was. Well, not only that is why she's in there. She had already seen Rebecca is wrapped up in plastic on the side.
Yep.
Candace is laid over there with a blanket over her. And she watched Angie get split open. Watched that one happen.
So traumatic.
She said she also couldn't stand the thought of even going in that place again and seeing what was in there. And she just knew that if she did have to go back in there, she wasn't coming back out again.
Right.
While Bill was still at the apartment, given all of his instructions of what these three hostages were to do as soon as he leaves, unknowns to him, a sheriff's deputy had already been on his way to the townhouse at that point in time. Rebecca's co-workers was already worried about her because she hadn't showed up for work in a couple days, so they had already called for a welfare check. Deputy Michael Burgess showed up at the townhouse. He knocks on the door, obviously with no answer. The door is locked. He walked around back where the sliding glass door, you remember we got the butcher paper on the window, so he can't see anything inside. Even the sliding glass doors on the back had the butcher paper. He can't see through them. He knocks on the sliding glass door on the back. Still no answer. He tries the door opens. He slides the door open just a little bit. This is before even stepping inside. Makes himself known, tells who he is. There's still no answer, so he opens the door a little more, sticks his head inside to the scene that's there. This is the second time while they're in court of when they asked him, what was your feelings? What was going on? Which any other defense would object to it? No. They let him talk. He talked about how in his time, I think he was 9 years into his career. this was the worst thing he ever seen. He said when he walked into the apartment, he just felt dread. He said it felt evil. It felt everything was wrong. This is as he was walking in before he even seen any bodies yet.
Just that feeling, that overwhelming sense of something's not right here.
Because you know it's thick. You know that air is thick.
Yeah.
So he comes through the sliding glass door. He walks into the scene of black plastic bag propped against the wall, legs sticking out from under a blue blanket, and Angela Veit still duct taped to the chair, slumped over.
Where she resided.
Correct.
Okay.
The very next day of the trial was 8 hours of they just played his entire confession tape when he was arrested, when he did his confession with the police, and nearly 8 hours of confession tape is what they played.
8 hours?
Nearly 8 hours. The reason the entire thing was played is they said, one is the prosecution wanted everyone to see through this of what kind of con man he is.
Right.
Because in this 8 hour tape, you could see that these women weren't just gullible women.
Yeah.
None of these women were strangers. They were friends of his. They were lovers of his. There was a sense of trust built up there. He was a con man, and he was a good one. He showed up everywhere he went with his cowboy hat and his boots on. He'd tell his wild stories. He tossed money around like he is a millionaire. And he had all the right words to be the man to make these women's dreams come true.
Mm.
They also asked him, why did he give himself up? Quote, he said, "I need prosecution. I need justice to be served. Because I'm representing 3 dead people, as well as a rape victim. I want justice to be served and the truth to be known so that people can get on with their lives."
So it's just like he's tired of trying to hide it at this point.
I don't think he ever intended to hide it. Not for long.
Right.
He went over how he got the women to also get there. He was asked also about his mother. What she would say, because you remember the relationship he had with his mother.
Yep.
What she would say about this is he said that she wouldn't be happy about what he did, about killing the people, raping Suzanne. He said, but she wouldn't have left his side, that she would have still been there. He knows his mother, and she would have still been there to support him, even though she wasn't happy with his actions.
I don't know. That's a tough one to swallow there.
They also asked him a couple more questions about his mother, and he said that he really didn't. This is after she had died, and he said he didn't want to talk about his mother anymore.
Oh, so we hit a sensitive place for this man.
We did. Apparently he has some sensitive spots somewhere. He had said that his mother had been, I guess we'll say, priming him, because his mother told him that his siblings were going to cheat him out of what's supposed to be left for him, you know, different things like that.
Mm.
So when his mother died, he forged 2 checks against his mother's account, and he stole some of her jewelry. So that's where some of the money's come from.
Just so he could make sure he gets something out of it.
Yeah, pretty much. When he began to talk about Rebecca, he said that she was the most loving, gentle, sweetest person he had ever met, and he stole about $20,000 from her. The investigator asked if this was closer to probably $60,000, and Bill said, yeah, that might be right. He used that money
just nonchalantly. Yeah, maybe.
Everything that he answers to all this stuff, he's so
literally just nonchalant. Like he gives none.
There was zero given. Zero.
Zero. I mean, absolutely none to give.
The money he got from Rebecca, he used that for strip clubs and limo rides. He said he kept up with what he spent for 1 month, and he spent $22,000 at a strip club.
Dang.
He also said that people are greedy and that he would use this to his advantage as well. The bar he would go to, the Stampede, he would go over by the dance floor and he would take handfuls of money and throw over the rail so that it would fall down on the dance floor just so that he could watch people come over there to pick the money up. And he said he could see in people's eyes, some people would just come pick the money up. He said some people wouldn't even make an effort to come pick the money up. They just had the look in their eyes of they want to be able to be the person that throws this money out like that. He said that he would use things like this as an investment. That he didn't see it as he was just throwing money out on the dance floor to see people's reactions. That he would throw the money out to see who his next victim would be. Because when they would come to pick that up, he would use that person to get more money from them. He said that all the women, all three women, Angela Fite, Candace Walters, and Rebecca Holberson, that they were very good people. And he killed them in a way so that they would not suffer. When it came to Walters and why she had to die, he said she didn't try to blackmail him about the money, but she did threaten to go to Rebecca. She wanted to have Bill. She wanted to have time with him. He said with her that when he started the relationship with her, it was like a pity relationship. And that he started having sex with her out of pity. That he gave her his personal time. He gave her relationship time. And he gave her sexual time as well. And he was giving her stuff that he didn't want to give. All this time, all this from him, he didn't want to give to her. So he asked her for some help with money. And that's when she gave him money. And then she started badgering him about he needed to start to repay it. And he said about that, why is she badgering me about the money? If I'm going to be a whore, at least let me get paid for it. To get her to actually loan him the money, he told her stories about needing things for his daughters, about owing money to people in Vegas, all of his wild stories he told to every one of the women. He said that Rebecca Holberton was a mercy killing because he had ruined her financially.
Yeah, but he really didn't until right before he killed her.
Well, he said that at that point in time, she was about to be coming up due on about a $40,000 tax bill and about a $100,000 nightmare that she was going to be a slave to forever. He said it would probably take her to, she would be over 65 before she would come close to even paying this back. But I mean, I guess that's the $100,000 is what he took her for, I think that was.
Yeah.
She's the one that he urinated on her face after he killed her. When he was asked about why he urinated on her dead body, he said because it's like the ultimate humiliation. It's like a way of saying, don't mess with me, and I've had enough. He also said in prison that he needs to be kept separated from people in jail. Because like one particular time in jail, he said an inmate was beating on his door. He said whenever he saw this inmate beating on the door of his cell, that he painted this guy's face into his mind. Because he said he will remember who he is. And the first time that he's out of that cell and he's within striking distance of this guy, he's going to kill him. He said, if I can kill the people that I love the way I did, what do you think I'm going to do to these people?
He's got a very valid point.
He also said that he had the most ultimate respect for the Jefferson County Police because they treated him so good. Even after the things that he had did, they treated him with respect. They listened to what he had to say, and they talked to him. He said, I can be two different type of people. The police saw one, and he said, if you cross me, you can see the other one. He said he also felt remorse for what he was doing the whole time that he did it, because he didn't believe that anyone deserves to die, but they were all warned of what was going to happen. He was asked, why didn't he use a gun? To that he said, because of the neighbors. He said, if I would have used a gun, the neighbors, the painters that were there, they would have heard it and they would have came. And if they would have, then I would have had to kill them too. I would have for sure went on to be a mass killing then.
Wow.
The bounty hunter, the hitman stories, he told them all of that was lies. Several times, I'm going to bring up right now, several times he brings up Ted Bundy. He said he's not trying to be like Ted Bundy, but he quotes a lot of things that Ted Bundy says as well. One of the things, Ted Bundy said that you're an actor and an illusionist, and you had to sell who you are. He said, so with his hitman stories and his bounty hunter stories, he told those over and over to everyone because he said in the beginning it was difficult, but by the end, it was who he was. He's told these lies so many times that they became who he was and he could tell these stories.
Right.
He promised Angela that house, but he also warned her about the house that if she were to tell anyone, that he would kill her and she would certainly die. And then she told people about it, and that's the reason she had to die.
Wow.
So the whole entire part about Angie dying was because of the house. He told her, if you told anybody, I'm going to kill you. And she told somebody.
Well, he stuck to his word.
That he did. I guess the one time he didn't lie. When it came to Suzanne, the reason he wanted her to live was he wanted her to send him to the electric chair. He wanted a living witness also as a warning to everybody else not to mess with him, that he's had enough, because I'm going to lose it, but he has not lost it up to this point yet.
Huh?
That's what he said.
I'm going to stop trying to actually be rational with this case because it's a very irrational person to begin with, but
if he hadn't lost it yet, what would losing it be?
That's what I'm saying. Like, what if what he's done is not completely insane? In his mind, what the hell? What would be insane? I mean, I'm just confused at this point.
He also spoke then about he planned on killing about 30 other people.
30, huh?
He had a list of about 30 people. Most of them were people that were from Shipwreck's bar that he went to. His plan was he wanted to get the majority of them at that bar that he could and do it all at once. I don't know why he didn't even try to attempt to do that. If that was part of his plan, I don't know why he turned himself in when he did, how he did.
Right. That doesn't make any sense. Either that or he's just blowing smoke, trying to make himself look like more than he really is.
Maybe so.
I mean, because we know he's good at doing that. He's very good at lying. And portraying to be something that he is not.
Yep.
As Ted Bundy said.
He also said about the townhouse, the way he left the bodies, the way he wrapped Holberton up in the plastic, the way he had Angie duct tape to the chair, the way that Candace was laid in the floor covered with the way he left everybody there. the purpose of him doing that is he said he wanted no way out of this. He wanted the picture to be so horrendous that society would not let him off.
I don't understand his antics.
I don't either. Some of this stuff for him I don't get. He was found guilty.
Like the dude's obviously a freaking nut job, but
right.
It's just it doesn't add up. Even being a nut job, it still don't add up.
No. No, it doesn't at all. He during the trial, a lot of different people came up and members of the families of the deceased, they had things to say. They had letters that were written about different things. There was the deliberation on this. It went for days. Obviously, the trial didn't happen for years after it was done.
How would it go for days? I mean, the dude's freaking guilty. He's sitting here admitting it.
One entire day. Well, yeah, I think one entire day was nothing but playing the video of his confession nearly 8 hours.
That's true.
He stuck to his word. Everything that came up, just like when Suzanne was on the stand, after she got done with everything that she did with the prosecution, you know the next step after prosecution gets done, they turn to the defense and say, any questions?
Yep.
He said none. He held to his word the entire time of the trial. When any member of the families came up, when it was turned to him about, it's your time, do you have any questions? He would not question. He would not cross-examine anybody else that came up there. He told them that he was not going to, and he didn't.
Wow.
But at the same time, he wasn't worried about trying to get out of this either. I mean, he's also said, you know, over and over through this thing was his plan pretty much was to get the death penalty. He was found guilty, obviously.
Now, let me ask this, not to cut you off again. Could this have been, you know how you have certain cases where people do suicide by cop? Could this have been his way of, he's just tired of his life and he just wants to, not in the aspect of commit suicide, but get away from society?
Right, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Not suicide by cop, but suicide by death penalty.
Correct.
Right, I see where you're going with that. I don't know. I mean,
that's just a thought. That's just a thought.
I mean, that's a very good thought. It's
I have them occasionally.
Every once in a while. I mean, it could be. It very well, very, very well could be. I got to the end of all of this that I've did for this episode, and I didn't go look to see what else I could find about him current day.
Yeah. Oh, so he's not dead?
No.
Oh, boy. You want to go have a conversation with him?
Yeah, I would love to. After he was found guilty, it was said, when he was given his guilty sentence, he was sentenced to death. And what was said to that was the only penalty for the brutal, needless killing visited upon these kind and lovely ladies is death. And then he was sentenced to death on September the 29th, 1999. But that was commuted to a life sentence in 2003. So he is not on death row.
They knocked it down.
Correct. I don't remember for sure if that falls into... I know there was a period of time where... I don't remember exactly how the law reads, but juveniles can't be... Which obviously he's not a juvenile, but there was one time where juveniles couldn't be sentenced to death, and there was another time where some of these... There was a law made where anybody that had the death sentence that might have been around that date, that time frame of where they got re-examined, and there was a lot of people that were on death row that got stepped down to life sentences.
I don't think they should death row this dude. I think they should freaking do the firing squad on him.
It's, I mean, I think it's
But
too.
I'm a cruel son of a gun.
That's too easy. But that is the story that I have for William Neal, Wild Bill Cody.
It's a very interesting story.
Yeah, I was going to make this a YouTube short.
There ain't no way.
4 hours later.
4 hours later. Ain't no way, brother.
I'm with you on the same thing you said. I wonder if that is his way of going out. But there's questions I have.
There's too many questions. Way too many questions.
Yeah. But that's all I have for this.
Brent, that was a fantastic episode. Plural episodes. I know this one did go a little longer than we usually like to do, but it was definitely worth it.
There'll be multiple of them that's going to come up. That'll be 2 and 3 episodes long sometimes.
Yeah. And the one that I'm going to be doing, just to give a little sneak peek to the viewer, is Samuel Little. I don't know if you know about Samuel Little or not. He's actually, I would say, the most prolific serial killer in the United States. But he's, for some reason, overlooked. And this one is a very good possibility to cover. There's no way in the world. I mean, this would be an 8-episode podcast if I covered every single crime that he committed. But it's a good possibility that the one I'm going to be doing is going to be a 2-part as well. That's all I got. Samuel Little, he was a ruthless dude.
We'll find out soon, right?
That's right. And we have the 50 State Haunt coming up next week.
For Alaska.
It's going to be on Alaska. Yep. And I know you've found a couple interesting places. I'm still trying to dabble and find what I want to really talk on, because my main focus right now is getting as much information on Sam as I possibly can. But with that being said, I think we're good.
Perfect.
I think your episode here on Wild Bill Cody was extremely satisfying in terms of not being weird, but is very interesting. Very interesting. And it's one of those cases that I would have never heard about him. And maybe that's something that we need to touch on, is those cases that's like, never heard about this dude. And I've heard about a lot of serious serial killers, and I know you have as well. And the dude I'm doing is the same way. I've never heard about him. But just to give a little information, he had 93 to 95 confirmed
wow.
murders. Yes. And he was actually, this is a little spoiler, but he was working with the FBI at the age of 70, 74. And pretty much telling them names and how he did it, where he did it, where their bodies are. So that's a little.
See, I think it's very, very interesting to me, too, for the ones that will actually, when they're caught, the ones that actually give this information. I mean, what's going on in these people's heads? What is it?
That boils down to psychology, dude.
Right, right. But I mean, it's one of those actually, which there's the different type of, there's some of them that are like sexual sadists. There's some of them that, you know, the different categories they fall in. But even when you give those, they fall in this category, but there's still these other things that transpire along with it.
Well, this one, you talk about sexual sadists and stuff, that this one would grasp your attention then.
I'll be finding out in two weeks.
It's going to get you. Yeah. It's going to be a good one.
I look forward to hearing it.
Well, hey, we got the, do we have our email that we can possibly put in the show notes or something?
All the show notes always have our email address is in the show notes.
It does.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
That is strangeemberspodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to send us an email with any kind of suggestions, anything you want to email. We'll read it.
Suggestions and anything that we could do different to possibly help us out, you know, how we're doing the podcast, anything. We're all ears. We might not take one singular suggestion, but we definitely like to hear everybody's opinion on everything.
Our link is on there for YouTube. Our link is on there for Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Patreon.
Yep.
We don't have a lot to offer on Patreon yet. There are things in the works that we're going to eventually do. And but all of our links are in the bio. And that is on every platform that that our podcast is on. The links are in the bios on every one of them.
Sounds good, man.
Well, I do want to thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here. We appreciate you hanging out, listening with us. We enjoy telling these stories that we do tell. I mean, even though they are dark and twisted most of the time, we still enjoy putting it out there. It's still part of our history at this point, right?
It is. It is history. And if we don't educate people on history, we know that history tends to repeat itself.
And it seems like with murderers, it just does anyways, right?
It does, no matter if you know about it or not. It's one of those mind things, you know, somebody's just not wired properly. But, all right, Brent, well, I think that's all for tonight. I really enjoyed it, and I'll catch you next week.
Thank you for coming to Strange Embers. Y'all have a good night.